read from the scriptures this morning. Joshua's record. Having arrived at this 10th chapter, Joshua's record at the 10th chapter. And we read only verses 1 through 4. I think your bulletin says 1 through 2, and that is the context of my message. But we will read for that all the way through verse 4. And I am reading again this morning now from the King James Version of the Bible. I had specific reasons on last week for reading to you. We read the entire chapter, and I read it to you from the Geneva Bible. This morning I return to the King James Bible and read these verses in chapter 10. Now it came to pass, when Adoni Zedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, that they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. Wherefore Adoni Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto Hoham, king of Hebron, and Piram, king of Jarmuth, and unto Japhiah, king of Lachish, and unto Debir, king of Eglon, say, come up unto me and help me, that we may smite Gibeon, for it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. As you know, the overarching title that we have given to this study, that is the entire book of Joshua, we have given that whole study the title A Faithful Generation, or the record of a faithful generation. But then, in this 10th chapter, we didn't have room in the bulletin to put all of these titles. This 10th chapter is, if you please, a mini-series or a designated study, which I have titled, Conquer and Possess. I said that to you on last week, and I think that was printed in the bulletin on last week, Conquer and Possess. And now for this message, this particular sermon on the text in verse 1 and 2 of this 10th chapter, I have given the title, which is in your bulletin, The Adversary Provoked. The text before our hearts here this morning in verses 1 through 4 contains a solemn, yes, a very solemn and timely warning for us, as we shall see shortly. Its theme is one which has occupied much of my thoughts in recent months, as we see the events that are unfolding in our nation daily before our very eyes. Its theme, that is, this text, is one which has crept into many of my sermons of late, either directly or by implication. Today, we will take it up directly. But before we undertake that exposition, it's needful that I lay for you something of a foundation in the setting of this text. You remember that this is, as I said, the record of a faithful generation. Israel has come out of the wilderness. Israel has crossed over Jordan. God has given them Jericho. God has given them Ai. God has given them the kingdom of the Gibeonites. And all of that history, all of those events up through chapter 9, most Jewish scholars agree that all of those events were probably finished and accomplished within 3 months. Matthew Henry, coming to this text where we are today, said, Joshua and the hosts of Israel had now been a good while in the land of Canaan, and no great matters were effected by them. They were made masters of Jericho by a miracle. Made masters of Ai by stratagem. And masters of Gibeon by surrender. And that was all. Hitherto, the progress of their victories had not seemed proportionable to the magnificence of their entry and the glory of their beginnings in Canaan. But now, when we get to chapter 10, that is all about to change. Gibeon, verse 2 tells us, being greater than Ai, and all the men thereof mighty, then here lies this city, Jerusalem. Less than 6 miles, some say 4, some say 5, but certainly under 6 miles away lay Jerusalem. And now, verse 10, chapter 10, verse 1 starts, now. Now. And now, for such a city as that, Gibeon, greater than Ai, all of her mighty, her men were mighty men, for such a city as that to yield so quickly and so easily, and in such a base and cowardly way, so these kings thought, was setting a very bad example for all of their neighbors and threatening their well-being. All these matters being accomplished now, verse 1, now, right here in the door, as it were, of Jerusalem, it all comes unavoidably crashing down on the king of Jerusalem only 5 miles away. Bush says in his commentary, The name Jerusalem here occurs for the first time in the scriptures. The original designation of the city seems to have been Shalom or Salim or Salem. Genesis 14:18, Psalm 76:2. That's what it was called at the time of Melchizedek. Though whether he were the founder of it, as some have suggested, we are not altogether clear. It was afterwards called Jerusalem, a name supposed to be a compounded name from Yeru, meaning to see, and Shalom, meaning peace, therefore signifying a vision of peace, or more literally, they shall see peace, which was a prophetic allusion to the gospel of peace, which would afterwards issue forth out of this place, Jerusalem. This city seems to have held a very singular significance, even in the most ancient of times, and even now, that first word in chapter 10, now, down to the time of our text, her king seems to have a dominant sway over the surrounding nations, we read in this record. He writes to them, he sends to them, and they respond immediately. Who is this king? Now it came to pass, verse 1, when Adonai Zedek. Who is this Adonai Zedek? Well, his name is easy enough to translate, is it not? Adonai meaning Lord, Zedek, righteousness, Lord of righteousness. He is a degenerate mockery of his own title. For you see, this Lord of righteousness has no righteousness. Indeed, he sets himself up to be the principal agent of unrighteousness, halting God's work among his people. Unlike his predecessor, in Abraham's time, Melchizedek, that is, king of righteousness. Unlike Melchizedek, he declared himself Lord of righteousness, Adonai Zedek, while being, in fact, Lord of unrighteousness. But then, after all, it was just a name, wasn't it? Adonai Zedek. These two names, this two-part name, among those earliest contributions, or among those earliest contributions to the science of political economy. Because you see, the one name, Shalom in Jerusalem, contains as much valuable suggestion as is found in many books in a wealth of nations. But then in that second, there condenses all the principles of sovereignty in one word, Adonai, Lord. And yet, the people in Jerusalem, the people under Adonai Zedek had degenerated since the days of Abraham. Then, this ruler was that Melchizedek. He was, the Bible tells us, a priest of the Most High God. However, when we come to chapter 10 of Joshua's record, they had degenerated to unrighteousness, and yet he maintains the same title, Lord of Righteousness. But it was only a title, wasn't it? Only a title. They cling to the title. Even as, if you remember, the kings in Egypt all claimed to be pharaohs. And the kings of Gath all claimed to be Abimelechs. And those of Damascus, Ben-Hadads. And those of Jerusalem, Adonai Zedeks, lords of righteousness. But it was only a name. It was an empty title. There was no honesty in it at all. So then, what is this man's real nature? What is his real condition? Well, verse 2 tells us he feared greatly. Feared greatly. This is the real motive, by the way. As we read last week the entire chapter, and by God's grace we'll preach through this entire chapter, all that you find in this chapter, all the record as it unfolds after verse 2 in this chapter, all of this motive is wrapped up in this singular word, fear. Fear had gripped these kings. Fear is the motive for all that happens in this amazing chapter. Fear. Unholy fear. Unsanctified fear falls with devastating impact on this unrighteous Lord of righteousness. And fear, can I remind you, drives men to outrageous extremes. Fear of what? What was he afraid of? Well, in a word, everything. That came to pass, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai. He heard how he had utterly destroyed it. He had heard how he had done to Jericho and her king, and that he had done the same to Ai and her king. He heard how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. He heard all these things. He heard all this, and he was full of fear. Oh, what great lessons await our hearts here in these brief verses. I give you lessons. Number one, we learn from these kings. We learn from these kings, number one, that God's glorious work in the lives of His people, even when it is miraculous in nature and evidence, God's glorious work in the lives of His people will not reap sanctifying results on God's enemies. We learn, I say it again, from these kings that God's glorious works, which verse 2, 1 and 2 tell us they had observed God's glorious work in the lives of His people, even though it is miraculous in nature, will not reap sanctifying results on God's enemies. Indeed, it will surely result in their enraged hatred being more deeply exercised against God's ways, against God's will, and against God's people. Adonai Zedek and all of his companions in crime in this text had heard the same thing that the Gibeonites had heard. They got the same report the Gibeonites had received. But all their reaction is to be inflamed with fear and rage and determination to fight against them. It's the old story, is it not? that the sun, the same hot sun that melts the wax, hardens the clay. All that God's works will do is to inflame the lost man's innate bitterness. I hope you're taking to heart this message this morning. I hope you're thinking about your own life and people in your life. I hope you're thinking about Matthew chapter 10 and verse 34. Think not that I'm come to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace but a sword. For I'm come to set a man at variance against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's bones shall be the of his own household. For he that loveth a father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He that taketh not his cross and follows after me is not worthy of me. I'm telling you that God's glorious work in the lives of his people will inflame his enemies, and some of these might be those that are living right under your roof. Some of them may be the nearest and dearest you have on this earth. I'm going to say it again. I hope God sends it to your heart. God's glorious work in the lives of his people will inflame the unregenerate heart of anger and fear. And some of those may be the dearest souls you have on earth. Number two. Lesson from these kings. We learn from Israel in this text these kings' treatment toward them. We learn that great and miraculous success. Oh, I hope God gives you ears to hear this morning. Great and miraculous success in the early days of conquest are no signal that the war is over. Oh yes, they've had great and mighty deliverance at Jordan. Oh, they've had a great and mighty display of God's power in their lives and a mighty deliverance at Jericho. Oh, yes, and albeit after a stumbling start, they had a miraculous and amazing victory at Ai. And then following right on the heels of that, God laid Gibeon right at their feet. But chapter 11 starts with now. Now. Oh, they've had some great and miraculous successes in the early days of their conquest. But my friend, the war is not over. Many a saint is lulled to sleep, ill-advisedly relaxed at the banqueting table of Mr. Carnal Security after the victory of some or other miraculous deliverance, only to awake from that sleep and find that Emmanuel has quit the place. And they're left bereft of his presence. Oh, thank God for those early victories. Thank God for those early victories. Lord, how easy God seemed to make it. Wife and I were talking yesterday about some brothers whose testimonies. I recall, and oh, I just want to shout and raise my hands and praise my God when I hear their testimonies in my ear, how God came and saved them. They took cigarettes out of their shirt pocket, threw them in a trash can, never looked back, took that bottle and threw it in a garbage can, never bought another drop of it, never touched another drop of it. I listened to Brother John this morning before the service. I was listening to the McKinney sisters. And I was listening to that dear woman testify how God came. Reached way down, she said. Oh, reached way down. Brought her out. Oh, and I love to hear those testimonies. I'll shout with you. I'll run with you. I'll bless His holy name with you. I love to hear about those early victories. But all my friend, those are early victories. And the war's not over. The war's not over. Come on with me to chapter 10 and learn now. Now. We got a whole new war now. Thank God for the early victory in some of you all's life. But can I just tell you, we are not yet in full possession of Canaan, and the war is not over. It is a foolish Samson who'll allow himself to sleep in the lap of a Delilah, and then find himself with his eyes gouged out, grinding at the wheel of God's enemies. Whoa! As your pastor, I fear for some of you. Early on in your profession, you saw some great victories. And I share with you the joy of that. But I'm going to ask you, what about now? What about last week? What about yesterday? What about this morning? Oh, how often did our Lord tell, admonish His little flock in these words, watch and pray. Matthew 26:41, Mark 13:33, Mark 14:38, Colossians 4:2, on and on and on. Watch and pray! This war is not over! These battles are demonstrating less of miracle and more of grit. How easy it is to be drawn away from this sober reality. As long as life shall last, the war is not over. 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion walketh about, seeking whom he may devour, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. You're going to need to get a grip. That's a modern translation if you want it. You're going to need to get a grip. This thing's not over. I give you a third lesson. From the example of these kings in chapter 10, trying just to say some words to get through verses 1 and 2. Number 3, not everyone who has a name, has possession of the things that name implies. Not everyone that has a name has the things, has possession of the things that name implies. I've already mentioned this. This man's name was Adonai Zedek, Lord of Righteousness. Oh! How well did John warn the pastor of the church at Sardis in chapter 3 and verse 1. And unto the angel of the church in Sardis, write these things, saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know thy works, that thou hast a name, that thou livest and art dead. There's a many today that have a name that they're Christian, and they're not. It's easy, it's cheap today to be called a Christian. But I would admonish you from these kings, and from this king specifically, that not everyone that has a name has possession of the thing, his name. Fourthly, and I'm trying to go quickly. Fourthly, I would have you to notice and learn that the underlying motive for much of our enemy's hostility is fear. I've already mentioned that. I want to say a word more about it. The underlying motive for much of our enemy's hostility is fear. But specifically, I want you to learn what it is the fear of. It is the fear of loss. It came to pass, verse 1, when Adonai and Zedek, the king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and utterly destroyed it, and how he had done to Jericho and her king, so he done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel, and they were among them, that they feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all the men thereof were mighty. So what is his fear? He's got a kingdom 5 or 6 miles away from where all this has happened. And he's afraid of losing his kingdom. He's afraid of the loss of power. More than that, of course. But he certainly might worry. The Gibeonites didn't lose their lives, but they lost their power. He's afraid of the loss of power. And he's afraid of the loss of gain. We found that exemplified in an example in Acts chapter 9, did we not? Acts chapter 9. In Acts chapter 19. You remember the record. Same time there arose no small stir about that way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with workmen in like occupation, and said, "Sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone in Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. When they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath. They were full of wrath. Full of wrath. And they cried out, saying, Great is Diana of Ephesus. And the whole city was filled with confusion. It's a fear of loss, of gain. Can I just take the liberty to make a very close application for you? Some of your dearest acquaintances may fear losing. As you find yourself more nearly knit to Joshua, they may fear losing power over you. They may fear losing gain which they have at your hands. They may fall into this fear of losing and declare war because of it. But then, notice this with me, with what great subtlety and intrigue might they go about it? You see, it's Joshua that they fear. But it's not Joshua that they purpose to attack. It's Gideon. Somebody well said the king of Jerusalem does not dare to suggest an attack upon Joshua. He can only venture upon assailing Gideon, standing in less fear of it than of the divinely protected invaders, and hoping at least by this measure to deprive Joshua of some formidable allies. Oh, listen to me. The unbeliever's hatred for God is such that could he hope for any measure of success, he would storm the battlements of heaven itself and drag God down off his throne. But knowing he has no hope for that, he'll engage his allies and all of his forces and all of his neighbors to seek to destroy the nearest open target accessible to his weapons, and that's you. That's good. Some of your loved ones would pull God down off his throne if they could, but they can't. So they'll find you the good target. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 21. Brother shall deliver up the brother to death, the father the child, and the children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. He that endureth to the end shall be saved. Don't lose this lesson. I'll give you one more. Finally, this morning, I want you to learn and I trust learn it well, this lesson. That is, the lesson of what it is that has brought all this sorrow on poor Gibeon. What is it that has brought all this sorrow on poor Gibeon? Sitting there as they are? Well, here's the answer. Verse 10 and second half. Adonai Zedek had learned that Gibeon had made peace with Israel and was among them. I give you this lesson. It was a wholesale surrender to Joshua that brought the wrath of the world down on their heads. It was a wholesale surrender to Joshua that brought the wrath of the whole world down on their heads. They had done nothing. They had indicated no hostility. They had indicated no hostility toward their neighbors. All they had done was surrender to Joshua. There's a wonderful word there in that text. They said that Adonai Zedek came to know that they were among them. Whoa, let there be no mistake about this. The extent of your troubles with the world, the intensity of your battles with your flesh, with Satan, and with the world, will be directly proportionate to the depth of your surrender to Joshua. This Hebrew word, among, used in verse 2, it's the Hebrew word yareh. You can look at it used again in Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verse 25. The word literally means in the inmost part or in the bowels. All this trouble came on Gibeon because they surrendered to Joshua and submerged themselves in the bowels of Israel. I ask you a simple question this morning. How deeply are you among Israel? Did you know that others could tell? Others can tell. I think that you are among Israel. How fully you are surrendered to Joshua. Others can tell. Oh, sure they can. Revelation chapter 3 again and verse 15. I know thy works. Thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. So then because thou art lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Hear me this morning. It won't be the victories at Jericho. Listen to me now and apply what I'm saying to your heart. It won't be the victories at Jericho and the AIs in your life that will fetch the hypocrites out of their fortified cities to pounce on your sacred head. It won't be your victories in Jericho and AI that bring them down on your head, friend. It'll be your submission to Joshua and an open and full and unconditional to his service surrender. It's your surrender to Joshua that will bring him down on your head. That and only that. I say again what I said earlier as your pastor. I fear for some of you. I ask you, where are the kings of pagan Canaan to assault your life? Where is the price of your obedience? Why aren't the howling wolves of the unbelieving crouching at your door? Are you well and truly among Israel? Are you in covenant league with Joshua, and does everybody know it? Have you, like Gibeon, cried out to the Lord in chapter 9 and verse 25, and now behold, we are thine, in thine hand, as it seemeth good and right unto thee, to do unto us, do! Ah, gee, I love that word. I love that word. Look at the Hebrew word of also, do. It means to finish something. It means to accomplish it. Joshua, here we are. We're in your hand. Whatever you think is right to do to us, do! Have you said that? Have you said that? Is there anything you're holding back? Anything you're trying to hang on to? If not, then you've surrendered all. Love of Him, I surrender all. All to be my blessed Savior. I surrender all. If you've surrendered all, can I just remind you this morning and warn you as you go out this week, there is an Adonai Zedek somewhere plotting your demise. Somewhere. But know this, our Lord has spoken, and we shall see later in this chapter, in the words of Matthew 16 and 33, in this world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Niko, the Greek word Niko, prevail. I have prevailed over the world. Oh, what a rich testimony is this! Gibeon, whose men the Bible tells us were mighty, whose men the Bible tells us were greater than they are, all of these in Gibeon have voluntarily submitted to Joshua. What a testimony. Oh, what a glory is this. When some mighty one lays down their weapons and yield unyielded, unfeigned allegiance to Joshua. This is a manly thing to do. This is what real men do. They bow to the Lord Jesus Christ and yield all their might in an unfeigned obedience to Him. And what will they find? Will they be disappointed? Oh, we shall see. we shall see. No, they shall never be deceived in their confidence in this Joshua.